Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
She's one of the A-listers of Twin Ports singer-songwriters.
Heart of the nation's pride never be set.
And after becoming a fixture on Boston's music scene, Rachel Kilgore is back in Duluth. Then, her name is Rose, his name is Blood. And though they're fictional characters, they're sharing very real experiences.
In summer, we come to watch the boats come in from all ends of the earth, and we dream of where the sailors go.
All that, plus this week's regional news and commentary on the explosive racial events caught on viral videos in New York and Minneapolis, after this.
News and issues from a superior point of view.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Was poetry fiction or nonfiction? It may have been weeks or years since you studied that in English class, but one University of Wisconsin Superior professor seems to have the answer, and it's earned him a major poetry prize. We'll hear from some of his work later in the show. But first, are you ready to hit the concert scene again?
Are you ready to rock?
Well, you probably have to wait a little longer before clubs and auditoriums begin opening up. In the meantime, we're thrilled to continue our series with this week's guest, Rachel Kilgore. She's clearly one of the Twin Ports A-listers, and if that doesn't impress you, she's equally popular in her erstwhile home in Boston. Rachel was already well known in the Twin Ports when she won the grand prize in the International New Song Music Performance Competition in 2015, followed by the top prize in the Kerrville New Folk Contest 2 years later. She's played at Lincoln Center in New York, the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and the Sundance Film Festival. And now she joins us from her living room in Duluth. Welcome to Simply Superior, Rachel.
Hi, thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So is Duluth home again, or were you just stuck here when the travel bans came up?
I'm happily stuck here when the travel bans came up. I actually was in Boston up until about, I think, the last day of February, and planned to come home, and my partner was actually in Boston. She was in a grad program at New England Conservatory, mm-hmm. and she actually ended up coming back, too, was coming back for spring break for a visit, and then never went back, and I never went back either, so we've just been pulled up here. We do have, a house here in Duluth. It's a rental property and a house that we're fixing up, so we've got lots of projects to keep us busy here, and I think I can speak for both of us when I say that we are very happy to not be in Boston while this is happening. I think when the virus started taking shape, it felt much safer to be in Duluth.
Right,
in a,
absolutely.
In a smaller town. Just to
Boston is actually, I believe, is like number two in the country behind New York.
Right. So. I'm so grateful to be able to still go outside and get into nature.
Right. And did you already have the home in Duluth when you sort of impromptu made the decision?
We actually got this house this past summer. My dad was a contractor, so I really like doing fix-up projects. And so we got a house that was in quite a bit of disrepair, and we've been fixing it up and got some really lovely tenants to move in the first unit. So as musicians, our income streams can be largely unpredictable. So I think getting into property ownership and rental income has been really helpful just to like give us a little stability. Yeah, Duluth will continue to be a home base, and I think I will always spend a significant amount of time in Boston and on the East Coast, and my partner travels quite a bit in Europe as well with the duo she has. So,
You've said my partner three times, and my rule is three times you have to identify the person.
Okay, her name is Sarah Bayunin. She is a violinist, also from Minnesota, but not from Duluth. So She's new to Duluth and is learning to love it.
And do you perform together?
Yeah, we do. We have our own projects that we focus on, but together our duo is called Sound and Echo.
And I have noticed some violin work. So is that her, perhaps?
That is, yes, you're right. That's true. She doesn't usually perform with me live, but I did come up with some string arrangements for my last EP, Game Changer.
Well, there we go. Because, see, I've known you long enough from when you were a violinist, not to say you're not one anymore, but that was your main gig.
Yeah, violin was my primary instrument, and I really tucked it away for almost a decade. And it is not like riding a bike. It's actually quite painful to pick up a violin again after many years because it sounds so horrible. And you remember the days when it didn't. It's very hard to work through that again. So,
all right, let's hear one of the selections that has Sarah on violin.
The song Wild Mountain Time, which is an old Scottish folk song, picking out songs from our shared or not shared ancestral history, using old folk songs and then making new arrangements of them.
All right, let's take a listen.
Oh, the summertime is coming, and the trees are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain time grows around the blooming heather. Will you go, lassie, go? Will you go, lassie? Will you go, lassie? Will you go, lassie? Will you go, lassie? Will you go? Will you go, lassie? Will you go? Will you go, lassie? Will you go? Will you go, lassie? Will you go, lassie? I will
That was Wild Mountain Time by our guest, Rachel Kilgore, with Sarah Payanen. And is it correct to say with? Because you two have your individual careers and then sometimes together careers. Is that a good way of putting it?
Well, we call ourselves Sound and Echo together as a duo. But
That's a better way of putting it, and I should know who I'm talking to. Okay, yes. And another song that I hear violin pretty prominently on is Game Changer.
Yep, my latest recording is Game Changer, an EP. It's title track, and it's actually a song I wrote for Sarah.
All right.
I won't be me, won't be my truest self. I wanna work hard and play hard to get my fill, and I wanna see you in the afternoon light, with your doubts and your certainty. I am scared, but I am steady. I could love you if you are ready. Game changer, cling to me. Your lungs with gold. If you are ready.
again. I am scared, but I'm steady. I could love you if you are ready.
We've just heard Game Changer by Rachel Kilgore with Sarah Pienen, a song that she wrote to Sarah Pienen. I have to say, your divorce, your previous relationship was pretty well known in the Twin Ports. One reason you were so well known is that that was part of your music. You had a song that actually almost became something of an anthem, correct, of the same-sex marriage campaign. Will You Marry Me?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. That song actually was, I wrote it for my grandparents who were not in a same-sex relationship, but singing it from the perspective of my grandfather, it has that feeling that I'm singing to a woman. But yeah, you're right. I did, I think often, but because I was an openly queer artist when I sang that song, it did have that sentiment. That's true.
Right. At a time when it was a big deal to be so, you know, which seems mm-hmm. almost incredible a short time ago. But
I know. It's funny. It's shifted so much in my adulthood. I think of anything making me feel like I've lived a significant amount of life, the changes that we've made as a society in relationship to the LGBTQAI community.
Right.
Yeah, it's notable.
Right. The main thing is that the sky didn't fall when same-sex marriage happened, not just in Minnesota, but the whole country. The next one is Garden.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about you, but the whole world is baking bread and growing garden to get through this thing. So for the last few years, I've really just been traveling all of the time, which has its own benefits. I've met a lot of really wonderful people, and I've seen lots of parts of the country that I had never seen before. And but I've really been wanting to slow down and to plant myself a garden, amongst other things. So,
all right, let's take a listen.
Up in the first place, dream.
that was Garden by our guest, Rachel Kilgore. I notice that musicians aren't necessarily on the front lines of the open up now, even though, you can't speak for all musicians or paint them with the same brush, but somehow I don't get from your community or that part of your community, if you will, the same open up that I'm hearing from other quarters. Am I correct right. about that?
Well, you know, I'm guessing we both are slightly biased in the musicians that we like. I can't say I have musician friends who are hoping to open up now. I did have a lot of musicians friends who were hesitant about the closing. I know it's pretty common for musicians to live paycheck to paycheck, honestly.
It's gig to gig,
gig might pay you very differently. So I think for a lot of people it was a little scary. It still is pretty scary, especially if you're supporting a family, depending on what your living expenses are like. We're having to be very creative. I have to say I'm pretty grateful for the fact that people who do currently have jobs and are comfortable have been more generous than usual in supporting artists that they care about. So, you know, we're also seeing an evolution as far as like online content and how artists are figuring out how to interact with listeners through the internet.
Right. And we should direct people to where online?
Oh, yeah. If they want to find me, I am on Facebook Live. Sometimes I will do a show. But you should find my website, rachelkilgore.com. You can find more information there about live stream shows I might be doing. I'm also, something that I've been really excited about is doing, I've been doing very small, like house concert sized Zoom shows. So it's not like a standard live stream. It's the quality of the, you know, audio and video in Zoom is not quite the same as what you can get on, say, YouTube Live or something, but it's kind of community oriented and you can interact. So I will play a short concert and I'll mute everyone while I sing. And then afterward, we'll like have a conversation about how everyone's doing. And that's been really lovely.
Right. These are some of the things you couldn't do in a concert hall.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's the, you know, best thing we can do to kind of feel like we're really there interacting with one another. And I'm grateful for that. And like you said, I am hesitant. I know, yes, music, art is central in a way, but not in a way that is worth putting our lives at risk or the lives of our loved ones. So I feel like I'm going to be very cautious about returning to the stage and asking people to gather until it feels like we have some, we're in the clear a little bit more.
Right.
I should mention, I shared a Sound and Echo song at the top of this, and we do have actually a live stream concert set for June 7th at 7 p.m., and you can find us on Facebook at Sound and Echo.
All right. We've been speaking with Rachel Kilgore. Thanks. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back after this.
I give.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Poetry is one of the oldest forms of human expression, and the simplest. You don't need a musical instrument or expensive art supplies, and you don't even need a pen to write it down if you're good at remembering. Millions of people write poetry, but only a small number ever become published poets, and fewer still win prestigious poetry prizes. University of Wisconsin Superior Professor Jason Iwin joined that club recently when he was named winner of the 2020 Miller Williams Poetry Prize for his collection Rose and Blood. His work was selected by former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins and is being published by the University of Arkansas Press. Jason also receives a $5,000 prize. But with the pandemic, you guessed it, book signings and other events had to be called off, so we're bringing them to you on the air. Jason joins us from his home in Duluth. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thank you for having me.
So I take it, this is like the old slogan from the 60s, suppose they give a war and nobody came, only there's nothing violent about it, right? Suppose they announce the great poetry prize and...
Right, right, yeah, cancel the book tours and, yep.
Right. Is this your first published poetry? I know you have another book out there, Gnarly Wounds.
Yes, my first book was a collection of poems called Six Trips in Two Directions. That won the Emergency Press International Book Contest, which is no longer with us. That was back in 2006. They've since gone under. But
which is not necessarily unusual for poetry presses, correct?
Right, correct, yeah. Small literary presses, and there are hundreds of them, if not thousands, and they tend to struggle financially, generally. So it's very common for them to, you know, to have a life expectancy of maybe 5 to 10 years, unless they go, commercial, essentially. And then they kind of cease to be what they wanted to be in the beginning, which was a literary press.
Right. Yep.
And I had a novella that won the Ruth Ann Wiley Novella Award at the Cleveland State University. So that was my second book, which was published. And then the book that you mentioned, Gnarly Wounds, which was also published by Emergency Press before they went under.
So tell us about Rose and Blood, and spell those names for us, because they are unusual spellings.
Yes, they're the names of the two characters who speak the poems. Her name is Rose Murtha. She's a young woman who lives in Proctor, kind of hangs out in Duluth a lot. And then the other character is William Blood, and the way that their names are spelled, Rose's first name is R-O-Z-E, and then William Blood's last name is B-L-U-D, and he lives in Superior.
And these two characters are fictional.
Yes, they're fictional, but they're based on a number of people I know, friends, family, people I've talked to over the years. So we call them composite characters, and the poems are delivered in their voices, so they're what we call persona poems. So you'd imagine when I'm reading them that I'm either, you know, embodying Rose Murtha or embodying William Blood. Mm-hmm. And that's how when I wrote the poems, I would kind of get in character and then try to see the world the way that I thought these characters would look at the world.
Mm-hmm. And again, you just said they're composite. They are fictional characters, but I'm taking it that they have some true stories in there. Before you explain all that, I want to take you back, if you don't mind, to my
yep.
sophomore year English class in high school, where Miss Parker, who I thought I liked until that moment, was going over the types of literature and called poetry fiction. And mm-hmm. since I was writing quite a bit of poetry at that time, which wasn't at all fictional, was my life story, I disputed her. You can imagine what my final grade was for that class. So I had to ask you, is poetry fiction? I mean, for most poets, I would think we're writing our feelings, our impressions of the world, even if it's wrong, by the way, we're still saying, you know, what we think it all means.
Yeah, well, poetry is really more of a genre or a form. People tend to think of it as a genre. So like theater would be a genre, prose is a genre. And then within those genres, you can have, you know, the kind of subcategories, which would be like fiction, nonfiction, mm-hmm. Lyric, narrative. So you have poetry, which is nonfictional. It's people writing about their personal lives. That's what a lot of 20th and 21st century poetry is like, actually. But you could have poetry that's fictional as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Milton's Paradise Lost, you know, he made it up.
He was talking about
documentary
what
poetry.
He understood to be a real event anyway. So.
Yeah, right. But, you know, he was definitely taking liberties with details.
Certainly the dialogue, right?
yeah, exactly. He probably wasn't there.
Right.
So, yeah, I've written, you know, what we call nonfiction poetry, but this is fictional poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love your explanation. I just wish you were around when I was in my sophomore year English class, you know, sitting next
right,
to me and
right.
I could have wheeled you out and say, well, Ms. Parker, Mr. Iwin here says you're wrong.
Right.
All right. Well, let's let the poetry speak for itself. How about giving us a few examples?
Okay. How about if I read a couple Rose Murtha poems? And then
okay,
later we
right.
can switch over to some William Blood.
Well, so tell us about Rose first before we hear her voice and her innermost
okay.
thoughts. How old is she?
Rose is a high school student. When I was writing the poems, you know, years ago, because it takes a while to write a book, I was imagining her to be probably around 16, her friend Kat might be a little older. This character Kat, and her name is spelled K-A-T. She comes up in a number of poems. So Rose lives in a trailer park in Proctor, and kind of, you know, overlooking Duluth. Her dad is a truck driver, and so she's home alone a lot because her parents are divorced, and her mother lives in over in Wisconsin, probably in Superior. I never got the backstory that, you know, detailed in my mind. But she's kind of a bit of an introverted student. She finds, you know, solace and escape, and she processes what's going on in her life through poetry. She lives, you know, in a low-income area where there's a lot of different forms of trauma that she's constantly being confronted with, and she writes about it in her poetry.
All right, well, let's hear her.
All right, so this poem is called Starlings. Whenever neighbor Angie went on a bender, I knew, because her kids weren't at the bus stop in the morning. After school, I brought them sandwiches so they'd have something other than cereal to eat, and I'd sit and watch reruns with them until she reappeared, until they all disappeared last year. When I was 10, and Mom and Dad and Travis and I lived together in a real house, one day Mom heard scratching and the water heater flew. Dad ignored it for days until he couldn't take it anymore and unscrewed the duct. And a starling burst out and flew into the utility sink, where it started drinking the soapy water spewing from the washing machine. Dad shook his head and grabbed it and put it in a cage for me, and I cared for it until Mom let him go. I dream about them sometimes, Angie's kids and the bird, and each time I find them in a dream, they've been waiting for me, as if their lives continue in my mind when I'm awake or away in other dreams. And when I dream them again, they ask me for food because I've been away so long. They've been so long without it. And I wake with a knot in my gut and stare at the ceiling and wonder how full my mind will be one day of dream beings waiting for me, hungry and wanting to know where I've been and why I can't stay. So that was Starlings.
As we were talking about fiction and nonfiction, yes. I can see the real event that may have been based on, because I've actually had starlings in my chimney flue.
yeah, exactly. The scenario of the bird being trapped in the flue was actually, that happened to me. It was all me wondering about what was the scratching sound, and I kept ignoring it, and then finally let it out, and I didn't put it in a cage, but it did fly into the utility sink and start drinking water coming out of the washing machine. And eventually I shooed it out of the house and it flew over to a bird bath and kept drinking some more and then took off. I've never seen it again. If I did, I wouldn't have recognized it. It just looked like a starling.
Yeah, they tend to look the same. So. Yeah. At least from our perspective.
Great. Yeah, exactly. I found a way of working that into the life of these characters in a way that seemed, you know, that had some symbolic weight to it.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with University of Wisconsin-Superior Professor Jason Iwin, winner of the 2020 Miller Williams Poetry Prize for his collection Rose and Blood, published by the University of Arkansas Press. So something else from Rose?
Yes, I'll read a poem called Music at Dawn. When the snowblower stops, the subtle world returns like clues to a mystery. Pigeons coo under someone's eaves, and a broken wind chime tries. Natural gas hisses through pipes like distant harness bells. Closer, the snow brushes my bedroom window. My heart beats so hard I can hear it below the snow and feel the blood moving in waves through my toes. I try to stop breathing, but I can't. My lungs shudder under a pain that grows in weight until the air tears my mouth open and leaps inside. Something, it seems, other than me, wants me to breathe and wants me to feel it. Hmm. So, there we go. Rose, you know, she's a melancholy type, might even be suffering from some undiagnosed depression. Mm-hmm. But once again, the poetry helps her to process that.
Okay. And another one from Rose's perspective before we go to Blood?
Sure. Maybe I'll go to one about the shipping down by the harbor. She goes down there with Kat,
sure.
In my imagination at least. So this one is called Vessels. Though the ships are frozen in ice, the winter sun warms our faces when we smoke down by the docks. In winter we come to see what isn't there. In summer, we come to watch the boats come in from all ends of the earth, only to return in a day or two. And we dream of where the sailors go, like all our little creeks pouring into the sea. At night, we come to smoke beneath the Milky Way, where stars condense like raindrops from evening clouds. And we wonder out loud where love comes from and how you can wear your heart on your sleeve when both are always changing. And sometimes I wonder if I exist only so these experiences can be, if they can only live through the shape of me.
Great. And from Blood's point of view, again, give us a little bio for Blood.
Okay. Yeah, William Blood is a veteran. He served in the Vietnam War. And when he came back, he pretty quickly joined a ship. He became a sailor and spent the rest of his working career on the Great Lakes and out on the ocean, on ore freighters and shipping grain around the world. So he is now retired, and he has taken to his daily routine involves getting his senior cup of coffee and food at one of the fine restaurant establishments in Superior, walking to the public library, and he spends hours just reading. He checks his email. Doesn't have a smartphone, but the library kind of helps connect him to the world. And he started reading a lot of poetry and writing his own poetry just to kind of process his own life. He's looking back on it with a mixture of regrets and nostalgia because he's been through quite a lot, obviously. So poetry helps him to reflect upon his life.
Mm-hmm. Is he married or?
He was married. His wife left him. Well, she asked him to leave. They got divorced. He has two adult sons now who visit him occasionally, but they don't live in the area anymore. And his wife died of cancer years ago. So he's pretty much kind of alone in the world. So I'll read. This one is a poem for a friend of his who passed away. It's actually also for a friend of mine who passed away. We didn't have the same kind of relationship that Blood has with this character. His name is Brian. But they both kind of ended the same way, shall we say. Under the overpass for Brian. After your little brother died down by the docks, I think was the first time we sat under the overpass. It was the Saturday night after his wake, and you told me you had to get out of the house, away from all the crying. So we slipped away to my place, grabbed a six-pack of Dad's beer, walked down into the trees, crossed the creek, and up the embankment, into a darkness darker than the night. You remember what you said? You didn't say much. We mostly stared at the creek and listened to the cars moaning overhead. And then you said, I think the only way I can get over him is to forget he ever lived. It made me so sad to hear you say it. I felt like my guts just fell out of me and slid down the rocks. But it was your right to feel that way. So I just nodded. I don't know why I'm telling you this. You know it better than I. Some Saturday nights after the bars closed, I waited for you under the overpass, and you never showed. And some nights, I'm sorry, I never showed. But some nights we both materialized out of the dark, and that's just the way I figured it would always be, though the years might pass between. The last time I was down there was the night they said you disappeared, 3 nights before they found you in the grass 100 yards from your bike, beside Highway 35. I think this is what it is I'm trying to say. I waited for you all those years, and you waited for me, and you waited for your little brother all those years, whether we ever lived or not.
And again, that was based on a real person.
Yeah. One of my friends, Brian, passed away, and he was, drinking and driving and just flew off the highway on his bike. Yeah. The motorcycle. And, it was, just really a shock.
Sure. But, my condolences. Right.
Thanks. So, would you like to hear another one?
Sure. What else is on Blood's mind?
Well, he spends a lot of time just kind of walking around town thinking. So I'll read a poem that is about one of my favorite places where I like to run, and it's out to the Nemadji Cemetery, where a lot of the settlers are buried yet. Really far back into the trees, though. If you wander through the trees, you'll find old gravestones in the underbrush. And a lot of children are buried back there, too, as in many cemeteries. All right, so this is called The Trees. I used to run, and now I walk to the settler cemetery by the refinery at the edge of town. I walk back into the trees where the wilderness is reclaiming the children's graves. Why do we always hide them at the back? Is it an unspoken shame we were unable to keep them with us? Or would it be undignified to plant them before their elders in both space and time? We always cross a distance to find them. Sometimes I go at night and stand before the tree line, and they seem to beckon to me. But I'm too modern for that. I know the trees end at the creeping sludge of the Nemadji River and the floodplain that soaked up the famous benzene spill. And beyond that, seagulls fighting over garbage. And I turn gratefully away from the children to the streets their parents made. So that's a little taste of William Blood's mindset, which is, I guess we could say it's quite, you know, somber.
Mm-hmm. But, well, a lot of local color there. So, again, going back to maybe I'm harping on the theme here of fiction and nonfiction, he certainly is talking about some very real places. So.
Yeah, definitely. And some real historic events that have affected people tremendously.
Right. One more from either one of them? They're all a bit somber, as you just pointed out.
Yeah,
so if
yeah.
you've got one on their more hopeful aspects, that might be a great way to take us out.
Yeah. Let's see here. I've got kind of a fun one. It's a Rosemertha poem, which, you know, kind of addresses a lot of the anxiety that the other poems do, but it's in a much more playful manner.
Sure.
That might be a nice one to end with. This one is called What Good Parents Say. You can go anywhere and do anything as long as you don't hurt anyone or hurt the earth, and remember that no good American would ever leave for good. The world is round, so you can't fall off. In fact, you can't escape. So, save the environment, save the animals, save us all, save yourselves. Run as far away as you possibly can, but stay in touch. We love you.
Well, I can't think of a more positive and hopeful statement than that one. And
yeah.
I appreciate the political stance you took that the world is indeed round. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I'm a very... Yeah.
Seems to be up for debate in some quarters these days, but yes. Well, we'll leave it at that. So. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Right. And congratulations again on the book and the prize.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with University of Wisconsin-Superior Professor Jason Iwin, winner of the 2020 Miller Williams Poetry Prize for his collection Rose and Blood, published by the University of Arkansas Press. And we'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
Daniel Kading, our Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, is on assignment. Earlier in the week, she filed this report on a consideration by the Wisconsin Supreme Court to allow lower courts to resume jury trials and in-person hearings so long as they have a plan to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Here's Danny.
The state's high court says circuit courts can move forward under approved plans that require face coverings, appropriate hygiene, and frequent cleaning. 10th Judicial District Court Administrator Christopher Channing says rural Bayfield County began jury selection in a local high school gym Tuesday after developing a plan for more than a month.
They were seated in the bleachers and were appropriately distanced for the CDC guidelines.
The Milwaukee County Circuit Court may begin preparing a couple courtrooms for jury trials in the next 45 days. The chief judge says it will likely take them much longer to resume normal operations safely due to the volume of cases they handle. The county has the most confirmed cases of the virus statewide. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
So, Brooks, it's been a very newsy week on the Minnesota side of the Bay, and for once, it's not all COVID-19 related.
No, Minneapolis has been in the national, if not international, spotlight after the death of George Floyd, a black man in police custody earlier this week. Protests have erupted and some have turned violent as residents and
yes,
politicians
they are
have
much
called
quieter,
for arrest of
about
the
100 people peacefully gathered one of
at London Road
in a now viral video kneeling on
Wednesday,
George Floyd's neck.
A couple of college
for several
students
minutes.
Organized this.
Right.
And said
there were
that,
also
you know,
some
we
protests
want
in
them
Duluth.
To know Duluth is watching them and we won't be silent. At one point, someone did drive their car through the protests, but no, there were no injuries and no arrests, even as someone rolled off the hood of the car as it drove through.
The city council in Duluth was also considering something on race relations, yes?
Yeah, actually, as protests really started heating up in Minneapolis on Tuesday night, the city council was debating the creation of an African Heritage Commission. And I shouldn't say debate because they unanimously approved it. So this commission will be made up of members of the community of African heritage, much like the Indigenous Commission that was founded nearly two decades ago. It will be a forum for the community and a direct line to city government.
And that's not a reactive to the situation in Minneapolis, right? They've been looking at this for a few weeks.
Correct. Janet Kennedy, Duluth's first black city councilor, introduced the measure a couple weeks ago, and it grew far more timely by Tuesday night.
What else has the city council been looking at?
Yeah, it was a pretty busy council meeting, and Spirit Mountain was on the docket again. The public ski hill is going to be closed all summer, canceling many weddings, banquets, and other summer events. As a result, they might need an extra $350,000 from the city to reopen as normal in the winter. While the city council has indicated they will probably find that money, the city's also many millions of dollars short in its budget and its expected tourism tax revenue.
Right. And the city isn't the only entity facing budget constraints.
Correct. The Duluth News Tribune this week announced it will only publish a print edition twice a week starting in July, and the Superior Telegram will also drop to one day a week of print publication. Both those papers will be mailed instead of delivered, and many folks in circulation and the entire carrier workforce will be laid off. It's a cost-saving measure, the company says, amid economic challenges presented by the pandemic, especially print advertising declines that were already underway.
Right, and they're certainly not the only newspapers in the country to experience this and actually to go down to less frequent publication. For both of us, of course, it's our former employers, and we wish everybody there well. Thank you, Brooks.
Thank you, Robin.
You can read these stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And finally, the death of George Floyd was one of two highly charged racial stories seen on viral videos this week. In New York Central Park, the world was introduced to dog walker Amy Cooper as she made a fraudulent police call against African-American bird watcher Christopher Cooper, no relation.
As soon as I saw the Amy Cooper incident, I could totally identify with Christian Cooper.
With a
national
reputation,
I've been a birder for more than 40
years.
I've also been a professional nature photographer for most of that time. And obviously, I've been a black man all my life. These kinds of situations do happen. One of the first I can remember was being in Ohio, originally from Ohio. Had a county sheriff suspected me of casing houses. So I'm pulled over, looking through my bird field guide. He pulls up behind me, gets out, comes to my vehicle, asks me if I'm lost. I told him no. I said, I am bird watching. He saw my book. He was so embarrassed, he just drove off. That kind of stuff happens a lot. As a wildlife photographer, I've had situations where people threaten to call the police on me, claiming that I'm taking pictures of the contents of white people's homes. I've even had a state trooper who someone called him, said there was a drunk black man on the side of the road. It was just me down on my stomach photographing wildflowers for a field guide I was working on. I've even had neighbors who suspect me of being drunk while gardening. I could hear these two women from a distance saying, "Is that black man drunk? I have gardening tools in my hands, but all they see is color." These kinds of things happen to black people when they do things that white people don't consider to be normal things that black people do. Now, the interesting thing about the Cooper story is also that this is northern United States. This woman wasn't wearing a Klan robe or anything like that, or waving a Confederate flag. And, you know, and she swears she's not racist. But clearly her actions are really the definition of racism and racist. In my mind, her intent is crystal clear. It's almost as if she is saying, "Who are you, a black man in America, to tell me to obey the law?" And I think she's saying, like, "For that, I am going to put your life in very serious danger." We know what happens when a white woman tells the police a black man is threatening her life. We know what happens when the police are involved with people of color. We see what's going on now in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. People of color oftentimes end up losing their lives. So to me, "I'm not racist" doesn't fly.
That commentary was from Duluth's Dudley Edmondson, an avid bird watcher and the author of Black and Brown Faces in America's Wild Places. That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Rachel Kilgore in America. Stay safe, everyone.
One by one we fall in line to reach for the precious prize.